Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
I may not be in this phylogeny.
What you looking at, man? I hit record, you know? We're recording right now. You know?
Really?
Yeah. We're going. And you're looking up blue ducks.
Yeah. Looking up blue ducks just to figure out what's related to. But I can't find it, so I'm...
They're weird, man. They're weird ducks. They're odd ducks, some might say.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Let's get into it.
Yeah, let's get into it. But straight off the top, Al, I got a big question for you.
What?
Do you say plover or plover?
Plover.
Do you say pileated or pileated?
Pileated.
Do you say egret or egret?
Egret.
Do you say coverts or coverts?
Coverts.
Do you say parula, parula, or I don't remember the other option.
Parula.
Parula. Do you say lazuli or lazuli?
Well, that's just crazy because it's lazuli. It's not lazuli. I don't think it's either one of the ones you said.
I usually say lazuli.
But no, it's lazuli bunting.
But it's lapis lazuli, right?
No, lapis lazuli.
I don't know. I'm not sure I believe you, even though you might be correct.
I don't know if I believe myself, but I will talk with great confidence on it.
Yeah, well, we are accustomed to hearing that. Now, how do you pronounce the warbler that used to be known, and I would say arguably a better name?
Oh, Prince. Oh, no. No.
Golden Swamp Warbler. Formerly known as Golden Swamp Warbler. What do you call
that?
That's
a prothonotary warbler.
All right. Some say prothonotary, and I think that's weird.
Yeah, because they're getting back into the religious word in Latin. Protonotario or something.
But I looked it up and checked multiple pronunciation sites, and they all say it the way Americans say it. All the Brits say we always say it wrong. They're like, it should be prothonotary. But, I'm happy to be corrected if I've – you know, our British listeners can tell me that I'm again wrong about what other British listeners have told me. But yeah, we always say prothonotary, and I've been feeling guilty about it for years, but apparently it's okay.
Yeah.
Now, what about, do you say phalarope or phalarope?
It's phalarope.
All right. What about this one from India and elsewhere, but you say Kukul or Kukal?
Kukul.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, Jerigon or something.
Ah, dude, that's my next one.
Jerigony.
Jerigon or Jerigony?
Jerigony.
Yes.
Now, is it, I got one for you, but let me think about it again. Yeah. Go ahead. You keep going.
All right, last one actually that I've got here, and then I'll tell
maybe
you my favorite.
Maybe it's the same one. Maybe it's
my
the same
favorite
one that I'm thinking of.
No, I don't think so. But I'll tell you my favorite mispronounced bird name I've ever heard. But this was okay. Do you say Alula or Alula?
Alula.
Mm-hmm. I can't decide which one I like better of those two.
Do you say Turaco or Turaco?
You know. For me, that's like egret and egret. I change between the two. I don't have one. I go either way. I switch it back and forth. I'm a switcher.
The South Africans all say it's Turaco. Mm-hmm. And I learned it, you know, consistently as Turaco.
I probably more often say it as Turaco.
Yeah.
Now, my favorite of all time was I was on a trip once and I overheard somebody asking if we had a chance to see any Sprague's pipettes. And I was very deeply confused about, and Sprague's pipettes. Is that like a something you use in like chemistry?
Did you say they fly around up high in the air? It's hard to see them, but you can hear them.
If they had said that, I might've had a better chance of understanding what they were actually talking about. But yeah. Sprague's pipette. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Sprague's pipette. Maybe we should, It might need a name change, right?
Yeah.
So
this is why I bring this up. Yeah,
Spragoose pipette could be, get the chemistry people involved, you know, feeling a little included.
It's true. You know, it's high time.
Things.
Yeah.
And Bacard, Beckard.
Yeah. Now, this is one I've always said Bacard.
And, yeah, me too.
And but my understanding is that it's a French word, right? So it should be like Bacard, you know? But I don't know if that's really true either. But that's the way I learned it, so I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, yeah. That's Beckard, Bacard, Jacana, Jasana.
Not Jasana?
Yeah, Jasana. Hmm. Yeah.
Or what about the big stork?
The big stork?
Big white stork in South America. Begins with a J.
Oh, Jabiru.
Yeah. How do you say it?
Jabiru.
Not Habiru? Or some other way?
No.
I often say Habiru, and I feel like that's a weird way to do it, but I just kind of can't stop myself from doing it that way.
Yeah. I think the argument of making the C soft in Jacana is really strong. So even if you're not going to go full on Jasana or whatever,
you just say saying Jasana.
Jasana would be on the money, and maybe
like Jacana.
Jacana, you know. Will you look at that waddle Jacana?
How about that there bronzed wing Jacana?
Yeah, a peasant tailed Jacana.
Peasant tailed. That is full of judgment there, it sounds like to me.
Yeah. No, I was actually thinking about this too in a different respect the other day about how we have leeway in how we pronounce some of these bird names, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have leeway in the scientific names. If you follow taxonomy, you're set with whatever the taxonomy is. If you follow the AOS or eBird, you've got sort of a set English name too. But is there ever anybody been like given the okay to spell things differently depending on where you live?
Well,
so is it the multicolored tanager with a U or not right. a U depending on where you live? Like, because right. it would be wrong for you perhaps to, you know, to write it incorrectly or gray, right? If you're the AE. And there's a lot of those birds.
There's many, many of those. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you get leeway to spell things in a sense, like how much leeway really is there in our names, even though we have official names? You know what I mean? It's kind of interesting.
I wonder, would that divide along the lines of which taxonomy you adhere to, perhaps? I would assume, but
I don't know. But it does, even though we have standardization, we actually aren't all using these things the same way. Otherwise, we would pronounce them all exactly the same and spell them all exactly the same, but we kind of don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a little slop factor going on in names anyways. I think it truly is like a Canadian checklist should spell gray the way that Canadians spell gray versus. And so there should be that allowance.
The freedom to do so.
Right.
Yeah.
It's my thought. I mean, I don't know how many words that would be, you know, sort of color and gray come up in my head, but there's probably others.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I gotta tell you, there's a couple things I'm pretty upset about right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh boy, the news. No politics, yeah. George.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. No. The news there only gets more strange.
The birding news.
No. I'm talking pizza news. Pizza news.
Oh, pizza news.
Yeah,
I'm not up on the pizza news because, you know, over here it's all sushi and tacos and stuff.
California pizza, yeah, I don't even really, don't know. Yeah. But our friend Corey Husick recently sent me a graphic, and I can tell by the layout of the graphic that this is authoritative, backed in science, and definitely 100% reliable beyond a shadow of a doubt. I sent you this as well, this graphic. I don't know if you saw it. I'll send it again.
I don't know. Right, I don't know now. If I saw it, but this. Yeah,
I'll send it to you right now, just so you can see.
Yeah. Something very graphic.
It's extremely graphic, and it's titled
"Beware, Everybody."
Yes, it's graphic. Strap yourself in. Trigger warning. Earmuffs. Favorite pizza topping by state. Okay, by state. And Molly, I think, would really take exception to this as well, because Pennsylvania and West Virginia are grouped together, in which it says our favorite pizza topping is corn.
Corn? That's weird.
Yeah, it is totally weird. I don't ever remember having had a pizza with corn on it. Maybe I have, but like I love me some street corn, you know, maybe even with some cheese on it. But corn on a pizza? I don't remember doing that.
I don't know. I don't believe this.
I just texted it to you, by the way. California, no surprise, avocado.
But I've never seen avocado on a pizza here. I've never seen that.
Yeah. No, I think Corey was poking the bear when he sent this one along. But this is another good one. For Minnesota, the preferred topping is tuna.
Yeah, that's nobody puts tuna on a pizza. Got to be insane.
I know. It ought to be.
Well, the worst one I'm seeing here, right? New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Carrots.
Yeah, no, that's just
carrots are vagrant on pizza. You know, like they're casual at best.
But I love carrots, but we never run out of carrots. There's a few things in this house we never run out of: carrots, butter, chocolate. You know, these are our three food groups here. And, you know, I love carrots between pieces of pizza, perhaps, but on pieces of pizza, I don't know. Seems strange to say the least.
Yeah. You know, all this is BS because cheese is actually number one everywhere.
That's right, which is why tomato pie is really just a sham, in my view.
Yeah.
But if you were to look closely,
there's a sausage triangle. Did you see that? The yellow triangle, the sausage triangle.
Oh, God.
Up northwest.
Sounds very bad. Yeah. Yes. I did notice that. I hadn't really realized the shape of it there. But yes, I did see that. There's quite a bit of sausage sprinkled around.
Yeah.
And pepperoni, of course, and a good bit of mushroom, and a few black olives here and there, and then some bacon mixed in. And bacon's always just good, you know. But
I think this is BS. I got to
tell you. Think so? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this cannot be. Poking the bear. But the idea of corn for Pennsylvania, and I will have to ask Molly later, but I suspect she would not be a fan of that. But the other thing that's really irritating me right now, Al, is I just returned.
No wonder you're angry. Holy.
Oh, I'm full of vim and vigor today. Was that I returned from India, you know, a month there, and I had what I thought was a nice bird, and it's my first since the split of American goshawk and Eurasian goshawk. So I think this represented a lifer for me. Was we had a Cipiter soaring around. I was like, man, that thing looks big. You know, it was pretty far away. I got some photos and I was like, yeah, it's a young goshawk, you know? And whoever the eBird reviewer is for that part of India, it's been over 3 weeks now and still no validation. So I'm going to have to, you know, write a little note and see if you know, what have I done wrong here? You know, what's the holdup?
But, yeah. You should start it with, "Hi, I'm George Armistead. You may know me from such."
I'm sure that'll go. That every time I've done that in the past, it's always worked wonders.
Right. You know, mm-hmm. Or just go right back, you know, my father started birding back before India was a country. And, you know, it's just, you know. Just go from there. Let's see where that gets you. You know,
all right. That sounds like really good sound advice.
Really good sound. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
You know what, George? Like, what makes you think you know, that everything's just going to be just rubber stamped just because you're George. You know, they're doing their due diligence.
I protest.
You know,
I mean, I was excited about that bird, man. It's cool.
In also Japan,
kind of a rare bird there.
We saw a couple, two, three. It was sort of like the jinx bird. I kept seeing, you know, goshawks in really poor situations, you know, flying through, and then it sat
it's
on
like
a tree.
It's like typical goshawk situation.
Yeah, and then getting the scope, one person sees it, it flies off, and, you know, sort of, but I think we had three different goshawk events, and the last one, it was soaring overhead, and, you know.
Everyone got to see it.
Yeah, moderately frequent, at least, is my experience in Japan. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty neat. But you seldom get to see
thinking
them well.
About it. Yeah. And I think that is so typical of them. It's like they're fleeting or far away.
Yeah.
Very hard to see well. One of my favorite things that happens here annually in Philadelphia is on some Facebook group or another, someone will say, well, check this out. Got myself a nice photograph of a goshawk here sitting on this apartment building. And, you know, it's virtually always a Cooper's hawk, sometimes a red-tailed hawk, but almost always it is a Cooper's hawk. And, you know, myself or somebody will try to gently suggest that perhaps it's something and they just vehemently, they will go to their grave defending these birds as goshawks, you know.
Well, the Goonlex hawk record in Florida, that was one of my concerns with it. Apart from, well, you know, I think Cooper's hawks might be more variable than people think. And it's like, how much more do you need to get one to look like this is one thing. But it was sitting on a roof of a house. I'm like, Goonlex hawk on a roof of a house. It's like, I just can't imagine it because it's a bird that can be around buildings and it can be.
Yeah.
And I know it sounds silly, right? Because I was trying to check myself on this, but you know, there's just stuff you see and stuff you don't see out in the bird world. And Goonlex hawks, you know, sitting on the roof of a house would be one of those things like, oh boy, you know, that just sounds off. And it sounds so Coopery.
Beyond know? Strange.
Yeah. So I know there's some aspect of you know, like when you mentioned, you know, the bird was on a building and then goshawk on a building. It's like, no, you know, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, as my father likes to say, people love to cherish their misconceptions, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I disagree with that.
Yeah. Well, Exhibit A. Well, Al, I think I wanted to tell you something that I am really, really excited about.
You know, really?
I've told you about a couple of things that I'm slightly furious about. You know?
Yeah. All the anger. It's really driving me down. You know, I wanted to have this happy, you know, podcast.
No, none of that.
Sucks.
None of that today. It's been too long. Okay. It's been like a month since we've recorded. I know. I gotta get out some good stuff here. One is that I am going to see Dune this week.
Dune?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a new Dune?
There's a new Dune, the second part. Yes. It's coming out. I'm gonna see it this Thursday, 2 days from now, 3 days from now. Very excited.
Are you like, you know the books enough and you've seen the originals and all that stuff, right? So it's not like you're going in going, I wonder how they're going to actually do this, you know, do this one, or how they're going to play, or you're just like, it's like a brand new story, right?
So I don't really read sci-fi or fantasy. I love novels. I just finished reading Demon Copperhead for anyone looking for a really good novel by Barbara Kingsolver, whose parents were birders, by the way. But
they've been on my tours.
The Kingsolvers.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I've seen them birding, you know. Yeah, it was years ago. But yeah, Demon Copperhead is a good book if someone's looking for a good book. But I can't – it's like Dune, I've seen it, like the book laying around. But But I just, that's not really my style of book. But I did watch the original movie, like a lot, in part because like when I was in college, we just had a copy. Like it was like one of
your
like
big Sting fan.
Actually, my wife is a huge Sting fan. She is like to the point that really it's like,
it's troubling.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like, you know, probably would have to give her a hall pass on Sting, you know? yeah. It's like, yeah, she's really, it is troubling. But, no, I like that movie, but the new one was just so good. I just thought it was awesome. So I'm very excited this week to see the second one. I'm really stoked about
that. That's good. That's the kind of movie I will watch on a plane.
Oh man. No way.
You know, but I'm not really, I mean, I hardly ever go see movies now. You know, like in the real, I think I want to go see where we're supposed to with Bianca go see the Bob Marley movie, but it hasn't worked out yet. So
I thought this was interesting. My nephew, who is 9, he said he's excited to see the Bob Marley movie, and he has predicted that there will be a mean dad in the movie. He was like, there's always a mean dad.
Yeah.
And I was like, huh.
Well, in this case, there's going to be a mean dad in the theater if I go.
Exactly. I was like,
that's not right. That's not the way it happened.
Yeah. I thought the mean dad theory was pretty interesting. It's like, it is sort of a formulaic thing, I guess.
So. Yeah. I don't expect a revolutionarily good movie, but I just kind of want to see it.
The last movie I saw in the theater was Anyone But You, which was a rom-com. And as you know, Al, I like
quite the romantic. Rom-com.
Yeah, I like
it. Not so funny, rom-com. But the romantic part you are.
Oh, that's – yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that's an entirely fair assessment. Yeah, I really do like a good rom-com. And, you know, they don't really make them anymore. So this one was like supposed to bring back the rom-com. And I will say – I was embarrassed that I had gone to the theater to see this. It was
now you have millions of people listening to you.
It was embarrassing, and it's only going to be more so now.
So, I was listening to Naturally Adventurous, you know, the other, well, there's multiple birding podcasts, but one of the ones that I listen to are friends out there.
Yeah.
And I forget which one of the guys...
Charlie and Ken.
Yeah, who it was. Maybe Ken that and I wanted to like respond to this, so maybe I'll respond to this here.
Okay.
He said Bob Marley may be the most I think he used popular or well known or musical artist on earth.
I have heard
I totally agree. And if you ask somebody on a tour, right, like our clients, you say, what is the best known band, you know, whatever, they'll say, oh, the Beatles, the Stones. I'm like,
these
you
days,
know what?
You could argue Taylor Swift conceivably.
Taylor Swift, right. Yeah. But you go anywhere on earth, like some little spot in New Guinea, you know, and somebody will know Bob Marley. But they won't know everything else. Like
it's true. I've heard this same theory postulated elsewhere, and I think it is probably legit. I think it's legit. Yeah,
and I think for the North American public, especially maybe some of the older, or I don't know, maybe even the younger people, never heard of them before. They just don't. It's sort of like Bob Marley. Like who listens to Bob Marley?
Well, I think like for Generation X. He hit us good. And even people younger than Generation X, right? And maybe even a little bit older than Generation X, but not much. If you're, you know, like if you're born in like the 60s and 70s or a little bit later, you will definitely have listened to a lot of Bob Marley. But I think if you're much before the 60s, he probably just didn't have the same reach. You know?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But at this point, as you say, it's pretty much pervasive everywhere.
Pervasive. And maybe there's an aspect too that he didn't live long enough to become mundane or bad. Like everything he put out was kind of good, you know, and
he couldn't hang on too long, like some musicians hang on too long. He was kind of cut down in his prime.
Yeah. Anyway,
churning out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't invent reggae, but he didn't start out as a reggae. Yeah. He didn't start out as reggae musician. You know, he was basically doing more ska and, you know, other kind of popular stuff of the day in the 60s. And then he just kind of gravitated to this new form and then boom, like made it worldwide. So that's also key. Like he almost single-handedly brought reggae to everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. Yeah. So, yeah. Ken, I agree. I totally agree.
I think it's a strong statement.
Yeah. Yeah. But why are we here? Why are we here?
Something else.
Not to talk about movies.
Yeah. Something else I'm looking forward to, Alvaro, is the Jerrygons.
The Jerrygons. Yeah.
The Jerriganese and the Tom Tits and the Fernbirds and the Weckas. Whoa.
Don't say those words. This is a family broadcast.
I don't think we've been recording the same podcast there, pal. I'm not sure. Not sure this could qualify.
I got to look these things up. Tom Tits. Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Tits. And why do you bring this up? These funny sounding birds.
Yeah. Well, we're heading there in December.
Yeah.
And we've got a good gang going. Nice bunch of friends are joining us for this. But I've had a number of folks ask me, and I think you've had sort of similar situation where people are like, you know, what's up with this part of the world?
Yeah, the subantarctic, New Zealand, Australia. Yeah, we have to include Australia because Macquarie is in Australia, even though we start out in New Zealand, right?
Like, it's
actually an Australian territory, so we can't just say the New Zealand subantarctic. That would be
it's a big
chunk of the world.
Yeah, it is. It's the subantarctic islands of New Zealand and Australia. And this is people often ask me, you know, what's your favorite trip? Which is, you know, if you've traveled like you and I have, that's maybe it's easy for you. I don't know. For me, I struggle. I tend to say that I like open country. I like high latitudes, especially, but really everything, a mix of everything is great. But I would say that of all the trips I've ever done in my entire life, that this cruise, the subantarctic islands of New Zealand and Australia, is one of my absolute favorite trips I've ever done. I would say it's a top three trip for me. I would have to think about what those other two might be, but this is definitely, you know, it's got elements that speak to me and I think really speak to the romance of wilderness. It's a 17-day cruise where often you don't see any other people except the people on board your ship for the duration of that, except for maybe one or two biological stations. You're unlikely to see any other ships out there. And so, you know, you're going around for 17 days visiting these remote islands that in most, you know, four of the seven, we will try to make land, we will try to set foot on. But the others are actually, you're not permitted to land at all. That's how wild they are. And in between those islands, you know, there's travel time, which some would say is actually maybe the most exciting time of all, because you're out in the deep and you're where all these seabirds are. So and it's whales. Like, yeah, exactly.
Cetaceans.
Like the cetacean list is off the chain. So like, you know, you've got, you know, dozens of species of tube nose that you're going to encounter here. You know, usually something like 30 to 40 species of tube nose, depending on what your taxonomy is, and including most of the world's albatrosses, which I know is big for you in particular. So we're going to see, we're going to encounter, you know, wandering albatrosses in at least probably three different taxa of wandering albatross.
And Ebert has split now, right?
Like, that's right.
Yeah. So, snowy, Antipodean.
Yeah, Gibson's.
Yeah, Gibson, I guess they lump with Antipodean, but it's a different, could potentially be,
yeah,
a, you know, a future split.
And the cool thing, too.
Royals.
Yeah, the two Royals, both Southern and Royal, will be in areas that they breed. And one of the cool things, too, with these big albatrosses is that you actually – it's one thing to, you know, to see them in really in their element in the wind and the sea and you know, coursing around. And they do follow the ship at times, which is pretty thrilling. But you actually get to, you know, like at Campbell Island, we'll get to – and possibly one or two of the other islands, you actually get to go see them at the nest. You know, where they're.
Yeah.
And then you really get a sense of just how big these things are. You know, it's, you sense how big they are at sea, but when you're on the ground and you're, you know, 20 meters away from them and you're just all of a sudden like, oh my God, it's these like things truly are enormous.
Yeah. Bigger than a huge dog.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
you know, the thing too about Antarctica, I find, I don't know if you found this, but a lot of people kind of compare like, well, I mean, should I go to Antarctica or should I go to the New Zealand summit? They're actually so different in many respects that I would say especially if you like that kind of part of the world, go to both. But there are some things that have become harder and harder or different in the Antarctic trips over the years. And one thing is it's much harder now in South Georgia to go and see nesting wandering albatrosses. Like they've not every ship gets to do that, and you see lots of wandering albatrosses at sea, but to actually see these big guys at the nest has become a difficult thing on some of the Antarctic trips. And also this idea of like not seeing a ship for days. Now in Antarctica, you know, you will see multiple ships every day.
Yes.
That are on different, you don't bump into them like at the colonies, you know, they might be on the other side of the island. It's really well managed and how people get to see things and not have other boats, but you see them moving in and out as you're moving in and out. So I'm really excited about that part of it, like just being places that are so wild and truly remote. Although, you know, on paper, it's like, oh, that looks a lot closer to New Zealand than the Antarctic is to South America. But
yeah, it's funny. Like different. These islands are closer, right? Like I think Macquarie is, if I remember right, Macquarie is as far south as we're going to get on this cruise. Macquarie Island, which is the Australian island, which has been surpassed now by another island. But for a long time, it actually was thought to have more breeding penguins than any other island in the world. And that is, I think, like 53, 54, 55 degrees south, something like that. It's basically the same latitude as Ushuaia, where you begin the Antarctic cruise. So,
Right. So
we're actually much further north, yet we will reach the Antarctic convergence because you get into areas where there are blue petrels and some of the more subtly things. We kind of barely reach the Antarctic convergence. But mostly we're much further north, and yet – these areas are actually much more seldom visited.
Right. And that the Antarctic and the subantarctic convergence lines, which are these important features on the, you know, sort of the ocean ecology that separate different avifaunas. It's really neat to me to see that, you know, when you're going out from Ushuaia and going to the Falklands, you sort of are crossing, you know, that same kind of region of the world versus, you know, in the subantarctic in New Zealand, Australia, yet in a different latitude. It's much more constricted in the, you know, the Antarctic area. It's like bigger, broader. And I start wondering, like, is it this deal with the fact that all these islands are sandwiched between these two important kind of food ecology kind of divisions that makes that part of the world, the New Zealand, Australia part of the world, so species rich? Like, because it's mind-boggling to me. Why are there so many species of you know, seabirds of various kinds, right? Not just one kind, but including the cormorants, the shags, and you know,
penguins.
You have the penguins and you've got the tube noses. Way more diverse than, you know, when you go to South Georgia, Falklands. And so So it's kind of like, what is going on here? What is so special about this? And I think that's part of it. It's all these islands sandwiched in between these, like, basically three ecological zones that you're near, you know?
Yeah, it's a good point. And part of that too is like what allows you to, like, it seems weird that you're going a place where there are all these tube noses, all these penguins and cormorants, and yet we're going to see also endemic parakeets.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that yeah. doesn't, Snipe. Those things, yeah. yeah, those things.
Ducks.
Pigeons. Don't seem to yeah. jive, but they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really an interesting mix.
You know, one of the things too that I was, you know, in my trying to understand this part of the world, I read that Macquarie Island, the one you said is further south, is like this linear island. Like it's like a big chunk of rock that came out of the ocean. And it's apparently one of the only places in the world where the crust, you know, the rock that's being built up as the crust is sort of expanding, you know, as two plates are moving out, where it's like just out there invisible and as this big chunk of island. And I think there's probably been also, because of the volcanic nature of some of this area, islands that have come and gone over the years. So there's always been islands and they've shifted around, moved about. And then, you know, when you get an island, you get a bunch of seabirds breeding on it that only go to that island, you get speciation, you know? And so I think that's also what's going on here. It's just this crazy geology that will be really interesting to talk about there with people who are, you know, the ship's naturalists will have all that info on what makes these islands different from each other and from the rest of the world, kind of geologically.
I had forgotten that unique geology about Macquarie. But yeah, apparently it is the only place on Earth where rocks from the Earth's mantle are being actively exposed above sea level.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's definitely unique. You know, generally speaking, these, you know, so there's the five of these islands, the Antipodes, the Aucklands, the Bounties, the Campbells, and the Snares. Those collectively are designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site and are part of this, the largest natural sanctuary in New Zealand, what they call the New Zealand Outlying Islands. And Macquarie also is a UNESCO World Heritage Site for, because it is, as I described the geology, because of the Earth's mantles being exposed there. And then we also visit Chatham Island, which is sort of semi-tropical almost. Mm. And that's where you get the Jerigony. And you get, you know, there's like an endemic form of like the New Zealand pigeon. And, you know, it just, it's very weird. It's got a real like element of Polynesia there, right, more so than any of the other places, even though they share vegetation. But you go from, you know, the subantarctic, at least subantarctic islands, to Chatham, which is really quite different and also has some of the rarest birds in the world. And that is where the famous tyco, or the magenta petrel, named not for the color, how cool would that be, a magenta petrel, but for the ship that it was collected on by Rollo Beck way back when. It is, I don't know what they number now. I want to say maybe low triple digits now for the tyco. But it's one of the rarest birds in the world. And they all breed, as far as is known, there on the Chatham Islands.
Yeah.
And I think we have a decent chance of seeing that bird.
That'd be kind of cool. Yeah.
Oh, it'd exactly. be way, way cool.
And then there are easier things to see, like the Chatham albatross and, you know, and endemic shag there, isn't there too, right?
And the Chatham albatross, Al, have you seen pictures of Pyramid Rock?
I know it like the back of my hand because I've seen so many pictures. Uh-huh. You know, I probably see the real thing and I'll cry.
You know, oh my God. It is something
I'll have
else.
I'll go into my room and do it, you know, privately, because that's not going to be nice.
Oh no, we'll handcuff you to the rail just so everybody can watch. But it's pretty weird. Like, that's where all of those birds nest. You know, it was in that shy albatross complex, but man, it looks completely different. And I would say it's maybe the best looking of the bunch. Like,
right.
You look at them in the book and they just look kind of gray headed and kind of pinkish yellow build, but they're actually in breeding plumage, are really a stunning looking bird. And probably most of the ones you've seen have been youngsters, I bet, in Chile. But
I think we've had an adult. Way back, but you know, but when I have, you know, Thanksgiving dinner and, you know, all that's all laid out, you know, I make my mashed potatoes into pyramid rock and, you know, make a hole.
So it's like,
what are you doing? What are you doing, Alvaro? It's like, I need to get there.
Close encounters of the third kind.
Exactly. Yeah. I was wondering if you're going to get that, you know, and they're like, funny music comes on. I'm like, I'm meant to go there. I have to see this place. You've Something's going to happen.
All those Thanksgiving dinners that your relatives suffered through, now maybe there'll be some peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those encounters.
And we were talking about, we're going to the Antipodes now.
Yes.
The Antipodes.
Yeah. Antipodes.
The anti-foot.
Yeah. With Antipodes, we found out that every place has an Antipodes, and like a place that is the opposite exactly on the earth as where you are. And I think you're saying that it was named that because it was thought to be about as opposite as it could be from England, specifically Greenwich, right?
Yeah, I'm going to look this up now just to be sure for that link. But yeah, I think that's right.
And I found out that Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
The Antipodes of Philadelphia is essentially south of Australia, of the, I would say, the east coast of Australia by a moderate margin. But that's the Antipodes.
Yeah, they said it looked like the closest town was Augusta.
Augusta.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I don't. Not familiar with. I haven't been to that part of Australia.
I know. What's kind of a shame is because the ocean, I mean, the ocean's so much of the earth. Most of the Antipode places are actually in the ocean. You know?
Yeah.
So
did you look at San Fran or Half Moon Bay?
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of offshore from Madagascar, right? Sort of triangle.
Oh, I see. Yeah. The closest thing is the Port-au-Français. Which is actually not, it's way south. That's the closest thing, but yeah.
Right.
Closest point of land.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know what that island is. It's French Southern Territories.
Yeah.
It's probably got some pretty awesome seabirds on it. But
Antipodes actually means really opposite, you know, diametrically opposite. Even in some, I guess you can use it as, not just geographically, but opposite in multiple ways. You can use this word. I guess we don't anymore. But I just think of it as, you know, albatrosses and penguins and stuff. Like, I mean, I had no idea what it meant, you know, until moderately recently.
It's a cool spot.
Antipodes albatross.
Yeah. And those the youngsters there are like those big woolly bears. They're all brown and beautiful. And yeah, there's also the parakeet there, the Antipodean parakeet, which can be a pretty tricky guy to see. So we'll definitely spend some time looking for that. That's one of these places that you cannot land. We go around by Zodiac. And it's the next closest island group is the Bounties, you know. I assume named for the mutiny on the Bounty. But I'm not actually sure of that. I should probably look that up. But if you ever want to see a place, like there's like a, what do they call it? Like a shipwreck, like a thing if you are shipwrecked that you can go and find. It's got like supplies and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And on the
Survival
Bounties.
Survival hut or something.
Yeah, yeah. And it's even, it's got like, it's got a bunch of stuff. But like, if you look at the bounties, it's like there's no vegetation. It's just like diagonal bunches of rocks sticking out of the ground. And it's just like, and you're just like, man, if I had to be shipwrecked someplace, that would, you know, obviously you don't really ever want to be shipwrecked, but it'd be pretty bleak right there. It'd be pretty bleak. I mean, the burning would be cool because there's just, you know, there's like Salvin's albatrosses coming out the wazoo and they're clamoring all around the boat and that, you know, the sea burning's pretty spectacular. But like just the rock formations are crazy to look at.
And if you're shipwrecked on that deserted island, you'd be sitting there going like, why did I bring just 10 albums when I could have brought food and other stuff that would be more useful to me?
These LPs are doing nothing
for me. I mean, like, yeah, it's like, what? I have 10 albums and 10 books. The books may be useful for a bit, but these albums.
yeah, it's a cool.
Obviously,
it's,
Bob Marley would be one of them.
Yeah, well, for sure. Yeah.
So, I got to ask you that, though. Many of the places that you sort of think of when you go on a ship to go look for wildlife, you know, with South Georgia or, you know, up in Svalbard and down here in the New Zealand, Australia, subantarctic, I think of as like really, really beautiful places, like places that make you, that you're taking about as many photos of the place as you are all the creatures. Is that kind of what was your experience when you've been there?
It is very scenic. And one of, I think what the landscapes can be pretty dramatic in places. It's not like Antarctica where you have a giant continent, you know, that is a backdrop with just intense, intense scenery everywhere. Mm-hmm. But there are beautiful scenescapes. And one of the coolest things about this whole region are what they call the mega herbs, which are a group of herbaceous wildflowers that are endemic to the New Zealand subantarctic islands. And they're basically these huge, huge plants, huge flowering plants. They grow up to 1 to 2 meters. And there's a handful of species or more. And they're really stunning. Some of them look kind of like big sunflowers. Some of them are more sort of purple or pinkish. But we're going at a season when these should be blooming. So you can, you know, as you approach some of these hillsides, as you're looking for subantarctic snipe or Campbell Island flightless teal, you know, you can be surrounded by these blooming anisotomy or bulbinella plants, the stilbocarpa, or the pluriphyllum. Those are sort of some of the more common.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, bulbinella rossi. They're quite stunning and they're big, you know, there's big flowering plants. So those can take what is already, a pretty, you know, rolling hills and islands big with steep cliff faces. And then all of a sudden you got these blooming mega herbs and it can be pretty darn dramatic. So.
I've got to admit, like there's part of me that I've seen these seabirds in books, or sometimes I've seen them in the non-breeding season somewhere else. You know, sort of like kind of well versed in the birds, and I'm almost not keen on looking at too many photos and stuff about the islands because I want to be wowed. You know what I mean? I want the surprise factor.
Yes. Yeah.
So just you describing these plants, I'm like, are they going to be like those paramo plants, you know, or are they like the silver swords? Or, you know, I start thinking like, what are they going to be like, you know? It's kind of a neat thing to have that element of like a place where I've always wanted to go my whole life, you know, it's finally happening. And I'm going to be able to show people birds and stuff that I'm comfortable with, but this whole other realm that's going to blow me away. And the whales too. I think the cetacean fauna and various other pinnipeds, you know, like sea lions, fur seals, that would be interesting to see too.
I think you'll get a kick too out of seeing some taxa that you are familiar with elsewhere, like the black-browed albatrosses that you've mm-hmm. seen by the thousands. You're going to see the Campbell albatross, you know,
yeah.
which is looks very similar, but has a honey-colored eye and the eyebrows quite different, and the underwing pattern's a bit different.
Right.
I think you're going to vibe on that, and you know, it'll be interesting to see what you think of some of these other things, like the Cape petrels, the Pintado petrels,
which, the dark ones.
Yeah, they're darker, at least in on average. I think sometimes pretty tough to tell, but. Yeah, I think it'll be cool to get your take on these birds you know so right. well from elsewhere and to see these different subspecies here.
Yeah, and I think too, I don't tend to like collect birds in the way that a lot of people do. I love a brand new species, a lifer, but there are some things that when you start like seeing a bunch of them where you're like, oh, you know, I have only one or two cranes, for example, left to see in the world. It'd be kind of neat to see those, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting, like, when I get down there, I think I will essentially see almost all of the penguins that I haven't seen, except for maybe two, you know? And that's pretty neat, you know, because penguins are just really fantastic little birds, or big birds sometimes.
Yeah.
Not just because of what they look like, but what they do, what they act like. It's just so crazy. So penguins. Yeah.
And the penguins that you're talking about here too are pretty special ones. Like royal penguin will probably see a colony that is maybe one of the largest penguin colonies in the world. There are many, 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 many thousands there. And then, you know, we'll have good chances to see Snares crested penguin, which is a really handsome, nice, fat, you know, good sized penguin, Snares penguin, and also, you know, an endemic just to the Snares. And then maybe one of my favorite birds, and the last time I did this trip was really the favorite bird, I think, of just about everybody on the trip, was the erect crested penguin, which are kind of these little, you know, little sausages, you know, and they just have these crazy crests along the sides of their head, and they're sort of smart and cute all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's yellow-eyed penguin, which is, you know, a Megadiptes, sort of like, it looks kind of like a small king penguin or a gentoo kind of, but it's structurally, but it's very different looking, and it's one of the rarest penguins in the world with just a few thousand, and this is the place to see them. So yeah, it's at least four penguins that are, you know, you don't see anywhere else, and they are all really cool, special ones.
And I guess you add on things like king penguins are there, which are one of the prettiest, you know, penguins anywhere, right? And in good numbers.
And good numbers.
You know, rockhoppers are, you know, I guess not that common, but they're there as well. I just, like the whole thing, I fall back to this, like, why are there king penguins there and all the way on the other side of the earth, and rockhoppers there and on the other side there? Then you have these endemic things that are only there. The whole picture of the evolution of these seabirds down in this part of the world is really part kind of exciting for me to just sort of like, I got to see this a little bit more and get, you know, it's one thing to look at maps and one thing to look at, you know, what the place where they are, but to be there and experience the temperature differences or whatever other differences there are. And you start going, oh, okay, I get it. This is why the one funny albatross that's related to the black-browed is on Campbell Island, you know. It may make more sense to me, which is going to be exciting to sort of like go through all that with folks and just, you know, as I do, you know, my musings.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the cetaceans are really great as well. You know, we'll have chances at hourglass dolphins and dusky dolphins and southern right whale dolphins we could see, and killer whale and sperm whales, southern bottlenose whale. This is actually a good area. I've seen on each of my trips, On each of my trips at the same exact location, actually, we saw Gray's beaked whale. And as I've detailed in the past, strap-toothed beaked whale I've seen on this trip as well. And there's even, you know, other rarer, different things that we could bump into in addition.
Right. Yeah. And you, I think when you went there, the ship that you used was an older, smaller ship. So it's kind of been a ship upgrade, right? Since that time, or am I wrong?
Oh, I would say so.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I would say the ship we're going on is considerably more comfortable. Yes.
Right.
It's a much, much, much more comfortable ship. Yeah, I've been on it before, spent some time on it, and I'll save those stories for another time, perhaps. But it is a very nice and very comfortable boat.
Yeah, so it has a gym, so you don't have to go rucking, you know, I think, George.
That's right. Yeah. I got to get out and ruck, by the way. I feel like basically after a month in India, I feel like I have been like taking ghee injections around my waist, you know, basically just eating. I'm a disgrace at the moment. I'll just put it that way.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's food in India is really good. And I was surprised that I didn't get bored of it. You know, like everybody makes a slightly different version of something you think, oh, this is the same, you know, that we had. Oh, no, it's different. You know?
Yeah. I mean, like every meal you have dal, but it's different every time you have it. You know?
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's really nice. The food's amazing.
Yeah.
No, Maybe we'll talk about that later today.
Right. But I love a ship-based trip because there's so many moving parts in a regular tour when you need a bus or sometimes like a 4x4 and some other, and then you got to set up, have all the restaurants set up and the whole deal. And then in a ship, it's like, there's a buffet. People can pick out the stuff that they want to eat as little as they want, you know. Don't have all those other complexities of a tour that are fun, right? They're fun. They're the reason why we travel. But on the other hand, it's so comforting to just
self-contained.
Self-contained. And, you know, you just sort of wake up and go, all right, I'm going to go to the deck and look at some birds and whales. And at this point in time, we're going to, you know, go to the island and check out this stuff. And, you know,
or
you
maybe I'll go soak in the hot tub until, you know, Alvaro and George spot some really good bird, and then I'll come down. Or maybe I'll go to the library, or maybe I'll go to the gym, or, you know, it's like, it's nice. I mean, your vehicle is your hotel and your restaurant, and the scene is changing constantly. So it's.
Yeah. No, it's a really fantastic way to travel. Like sort of Galapagos, it's the same thing. People wake up, it's like, we're in a new place, you know, it's like, and then everything's kind of done for you. It's so relaxing in a sense, you know. A lot of people worry about like, oh, the ship and whatever, what's the weather going to be like? And they never think about how utterly, like, awesomely relaxing it can be to be on a ship. And these aren't huge, huge ships, right? They're a little bit more cozy than that. You get to know people, you know, they're you know, what's 150?
Yeah, it's a little something. Less. Yeah,
100 and something passengers. So it's it becomes like this community. It's a really nice feel to be on these expedition ships going
it's,
out.
It's always funny too. Like after you'd be on the shipboard a week, and then all of a sudden you'll see some. You'd be like, I never saw that person before. Where'd they come from?
I'm really looking forward to it, and we'll. You know, I almost don't know what to get excited about because it's all exciting, you know.
Yeah.
And for me, it's even a whole new section of the world. You know, there's been I do have a lot of people that go on sometimes on my trips when I first do them because they want to see like excited Alvaro going, oh my God, look at that thing.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, as someone, you know, as a lifelong bud and knowing how much time you've spent in Hawaii and knowing how much time you've spent at Easter Island, getting to go with you to the other corner of the Polynesian Triangle for the first time, I'm excited about that, you know,
yeah.
Like, and so that, I mean, that's going to be a lot of fun. And like, you know, you get to learn, we'll learn something about, you know, the Maori and the Maori language. And you see a lot of similarities to what you're probably yeah. familiar with from Rapa Nui or from Hawaii and in the language and the people. You know, there are definitely some unifying things, but also in the biome itself, you know, there's like, right. there's Metrosideros trees, you know, in both, just like the Ohialehua, you know, you'll see yeah. those on the mainland New Zealand as well. And it's sort of like, oh, wow. Like we're on the other side of the Pacific pretty much. And, you know, you're going to recognize some plant life.
It's ironic. I have one in my front yard.
Is that right?
Yeah. See, we call them New Zealand Christmas trees here.
Wow.
And it's like a common coastal California garden tree, you know, good mm-hmm. bird tree. So it's like, you know, a really great place for nesting. It's
interesting.
Yeah. Metrosideros. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing that's cool too, I think that people will learn about on the trip, but that even if you can't go on the trip, you can learn about is what a frontier of conservation these places are. Campbell Island in particular was where I think it was the first place where they did one of these massive rat eradication programs where they dropped, they dropped a toxin for rats all across the island. And when I was there last, we actually found, I think it was the first evidence of breeding of Campbell Island teal, which is a flightless duck, in like decades.
Wow.
And we actually caught a duckling. We never saw an adult, and we didn't realize what we were catching at the time. And then later we were like, oh my God, we're really not supposed to catch these things. Hopefully the statute of limitations is up on that. But we all of a sudden we realized we had this little Campbell Island flightless teal duckling, and we had photos of it. And I mean, now those are not that hard to find, you know, like mm-hmm. We should probably encounter those while we're there. Same with the snipe. These are, you know, flightless birds that are there, and that because of the incredible conservation efforts by the Department of Conservation, DOC, as they call it in New Zealand, we'll have a DOC officer on board with us to teach us about all of this. It's just an incredible story what's happened at Campbell Island. Also, they're undergoing the same kind of treatment at Macquarie Island, where they have a big problem with rabbits. But the birds just, you know, you give them a little space and they really come back. So I'm excited to see how different Campbell Island is from the last time I was there.
Yeah, I've heard the Macquarie Island work has really been successful. Like they've eradicated multiple species of introduced mammal at this point. I think, I don't know if they've, you know, long term, you know, they've been able to confirm that they're gone, but that the vegetation and the birds are popping back,
coming back
in a way that hasn't been seen, you know, in living history. Right.
Like
this is, we're talking, some of these introductions happened in the 1800s. Nobody alive, even our parents or grandparents, can picture what these places look like, and they're coming back, you know.
Yeah. So, it's exciting.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. New Zealand, definitely at the forefront of island conservation. And here, you know, with the Farallon Islands, that project has a lot of involvement, you know, in terms of like the techniques of what's been done in New Zealand and also other places in South America now, where they're trying to do, you know, restorations of islands. People who did it first. So it's going to be really neat to see their work and enjoy the fruits of that conservation work. And
yeah,
you know, and in a sense, bring it to other folks, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They have, and it's cool to see what's happened there and to see how that ethic and methodology has spread elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should scoot, in part because you and I are going to record a little later today as well. And because between now and then, we both have stuff to do. Before we go, Al, I want to remind folks, check out the Life List newsletter. Now, you can subscribe to this by going to lifelistpodcast.com. Scroll down a little ways on the site and you'll see it right there. You can subscribe to the Lifelist newsletter. This is twice a month. It's not going to spam your inbox. And there's lots of cool articles. Our friend Eric Bonesley is curating this, obviously with the help of myself, Molly, and Alvaro. And we're pretty excited about it. It's been a lot of fun so far. There's a little bit of trivia in there, interesting news and articles, and just fun bird stuff that we think is cool. So definitely take a look there. And Al, is there anything else you want to let folks know about before we scoot here?
April, Cuba, 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 Cuba. If you have never even thought of going to Cuba, one of the most exciting, amazing places in the Caribbean.
And, one of the coolest. Definitely yeah. The coolest place on earth, and like what, 90 miles from Miami or something.
Yeah. And it's not always on the radar for people because they think that maybe it's not allowed to go there. You're allowed to go there. You're allowed to go and, you know, survey birds as we do out there. And you will see endemics. You will listen to great music. You will have potential, if you are into this, of drinking some great rum and just having a great time. The Cuban people are amazing. So don't even think about it. Just go.
Do it. Yeah.
Do it.
I'm eager to get back myself. Yeah. Check it out. Alvarosadventures.com. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks, Al. Thanks, everybody. We will be back again soon. Cheers, y'all.
Bye-bye.